So we begin by looking at Psalm 28. As I understand it, it's an urgent plea that God will confront the wicked and continue like a shepherd to watch over the king and bless those who act with justice. We hear the cry of Yahweh's anointed king in the last verse of the psalm. So we begin. You, Yahweh, I call on you. My rock, do not refuse to hear me. If you are silent to me, I shall be among those who go down to the pit. The pit, of course, is the grave. If you are silent to me, I shall be among those who go down to the pit. And we might, as we pray it, as followers of Jesus, hear Jesus crying out in his agony, Father, I call on you, etc. And on the cross, his piercing cry met only by the silence of God, which is a big factor of our experience. And a lot's written about it. God is mostly silent. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes.
So it's a factor of our experience that we have this immense eternal longing and it can't be met here. And so often we seem not to be being heard or there's no response that we can pick up. And we call it the silence or the absence of God. Because God necessarily is beyond all the words we hear, all the experiences merely within the range of what's possible for human beings here, depending on our senses and so on. So ultimately, there is a silence that's not empty, but draws us beyond. And this psalmist is very aware of it, as I presume we all are. And he continues, Hear the sound of my pleading as I cry to you for help, as I lift up my hands towards your most holy. Now here we have some difficulty. Your most holy sanctuary. Now we need to know the Hebrew word and the Greek equivalent to know in precise terms what we're talking about. Because there's a general temple complex, and you would have heard there's the holy place, which is where the priests could go, and where there was the altar of sacrifice and so on. But then there was the inner sanctum, or the holy of holies, often called, or the holiest place. And from the Hebrew here, debir, and the Greek naos, we know we're talking about that actual inner holy of holiest place behind the curtain where all you had was the Ark of the Covenant and its golden table top. The kippur, the cover, and then the two cherubim, and in that empty space, because they didn't imagine God, they refused to imagine God in any visual way, there was an empty space there where they believed God touched the earth, and only the high priest could go into that place once a year. So that's where he's referring to. The sanctuary in this case is not simply the temple, but that place where God actually dwells in the temple, in the Holy of Holies, the Naos, or the Debir. We find that same word used throughout the Bible, of course, in different settings, though from the English you can't often tell whether it's talking about the temple as a big complex building or the actual Debir, the holiest place. A And now I think we can simply read through the psalm, unless you need explanation at the end. It speaks for itself, I think. Do not drag me away with the wicked. The wicked is the way it's often translated. Irreligious may be a better term for this particular word. It means those who don't take into consideration the sacred when they make decisions in life, who don't perceive that the world is not just two-dimensional or flat or empty, but the world has depth. And in a culture like ours, if I could say this, and you may agree or disagree, and I guess it's a culture that tends to focus so much on the surface and the attainable and the physically organizable and the controllable and the movement and all that, a world that's very focused on the senses and so on. Depthing is exactly what we all need to do, and often we're not helped to do it by the quick movement of our culture. And education is, in my time, of course, my age, you'd all know, in my time there was much more time for contemplation and quiet and growing up slowly, and it wasn't all good, I'm sure, but there was a lot of, and if any of you from the country, well, you have to be contemplative because you just watch the soil and you wait for the harvest and you, but for city young people today, where everything's happening so fast, and where they're learning, not, well, hopefully they might be, but where their learning is focused on accessing information well, it's still very superficial, really, accessing information. Hopefully their teachers are also telling them how to depth, how to be silent, how to engage the mystery, how to recognize the sacred, all of that. Well, the word used here, the wicked are those who, because religion, of course, is that which binds things to the centre. Religion can be used as a bad word, but there's no reason for using it as a bad word, and I refuse to go along that track. People talk about, oh, no, what we need is a spirituality, not religion, blow. I'm not going to pinch our words. Religion is a profound reality of, how's your Latin, religo, binding back, binding again, ligament, ligation. Religion is that which binds me and us back to the very core centre of who we really are. Now, religions don't always do that. And people hijack religion for a whole lot of purposes that are nothing to do with the sacred. But at its best, that's what religion is. So these people are those in the psalm who are not concerned with the depth, with the sacred, with the mystery, with praise and adoration and wonder, but are concerned with political or economic manipulation for their own advantage. It's a long bit for the wicked, okay. So don't drag me off with them, he says, with those who do evil, offering a greeting of peace to their neighbours, but mischief is in their heart. They say shalom when you come, but the daggers are out, and they're going to have workplace relationships which give you no power, because they are a big institution and you're just an ordinary person in an economy where there's others, other fish to catch too, and if you don't want their terms, they don't need you, so they'll get someone else. So you have to kind of not come in a dignified way, but accept the big corporate powerful limits to you. So they say shalom, but you're left undignified and fairly powerless. Mischief is in their hearts. Repay them, says the psalmist, according to what they do, the evil of their deeds. Repay them according to their actions. Repay them as much as they deserve. Not as beautiful an emotion as Jesus had on the cross when he said, no, I've got to just love these people more or they'll never find their way out of it. Father, forgive them, they don't know what they do. But this is a very understandable feeling. He wants God on his side to somehow give him some movement. So get back at them and pull them down and so on. Because they have no regard for what Yahweh is doing. Perfect description of the Rasha, the wicked, for the work of God's hands. What is God doing? What is God doing with this person? What is God doing with this environment? What is the mystery of the love that's entering in our world doing with this baby, this child, this teenager, this person? What is the sacredness there? No, they're not concerned with that. They're concerned with how can I use this human resource? I know it's a word that's used commonly, but what a way to describe a person as a part of the human resources. Like it's a bit like, well, I think it's dreadful, but anyhow. This is a unique individual person who is a mystery with so much to give and so sacred. But if we don't go to that depth, we will never learn to, we'll never benefit. The country won't be as beautiful as it should be either, of course. So these have no regard for the what is God is doing in the world. He will break them down and not build them up again. Well, the psalm concludes, it's a fairly brief and not that difficult to grasp psalm. Blessed be Yahweh, who hears the sound of my pleading. Yahweh is my strength, my shield. In him my heart trusts. He has helped me. My heart exalts, and with my song I give thanks to him. Yahweh is the strength of his people. He is the saving refuge of his anointed. Anointed, Meshiach, king, basically the king. And then it concludes, help your people. And this is probably the king crying out. Help your people, bless your heritage, be their shepherd, and sustain them forever. This is a very good example of something I won't be able to do very often, but I'll do it now because it's another element of translating the Psalms which the scholars have to deal with. The English translation I have followed here is in the New Revised Standard Version and generally in the English translations, and it says in verse 8, Yahweh is the strength of his people. Now, in fact, if you look up the Masoretic Hebrew text, which is it's written in Hebrew, the Hebrew says, you are the strength to him, lamo. You are strength, lamo, always the masculine pronoun, to him. You are his strength. However, the Greek Septuagint version reads, you are the strength to lao, laos, laity, means people, of his people. So they're actually different. Not a terrific world of difference, but you are his strength or you are the strength of his people. Which is correct, the Greek or the Hebrew? The Hebrew equivalent of his people, if you'd look at it here, is le amo. It's got an ayin in there, le amo. The ayin is simply a glottal stop with a bit of a deeper one than the aleph. Le amo, some kind, I don't know how they've made the sound, but a sound from the throat. Can you see why the scholars suggest here that the Greek is more authentic? Because what's happened, the difference in the Hebrew between le amo and lamo is simply the absence of the guttural sound. It would be quite easy listening for someone to say to the people writing the script, and you're copying it, and it's a pretty expensive and skilled task, and I say, you are the strength lamo, le amo, and you hear lamo, so you write lamo. But, so in other words, the Hebrew text we have now, the assumption is it's actually defective. We've got a text based on a wrong scribal, a mistake written by the scribes. Whereas the Septuagint version, translated back in the 2nd century BC by Jewish scholars, must have had a text that they were translating which had le amour. And probably they did it in visually or whatever. So this is an example, and I won't go on about it, there's no need to, because I think it's clear to you, where when the Greek and the Hebrew are different, you don't always assume the Hebrew is the correct version. Because the Hebrew we have, the Masoretic text, which goes right back, but it goes back to the end of the 1st century AD, after Christianity had emerged and Judaism was bleeding from within, because a lot of them were becoming Christian, and the temple had been destroyed, so the very, and Jerusalem, you know, so they were in a desperate state, and they kind of retired to the coast, and the scholars there fixed their canon very strongly so that people, Judaism had to become, I won't say ghetto-ish, but very self-protective. The way Catholicism had to become in Ireland, for example, with the onslaught of the English power that was destroying the culture and the religion and martyrs and persecution and, you know, all that, and taking land, and people tend to, don't they, tighten to defend themselves. So when they did that, they fixed the canon. But there are other texts way back, and in this case, the assumption is that the actual Greek is coming from a more authentic Hebrew text. Sorry to say all that, but I guess it's just an example of, for you, of what the scholars have to do. Yahweh is the strength of his people. He is the saving refuge of his anointed.